Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome everyone to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Dan Foster of National Review Online. And for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Dan, our good news is something that we're actually going to watch next week on the floor of the House of Representatives. Some people remember, maybe not everybody, that part of the debt ceiling deal was that there would be at least a vote on a balanced budget amendment. Republicans, of course, wanted more in cut, cap, and balance. But in the end, they settled for a vote on it in the House and Senate, and they are going to vote on it in the House next week. Now, the version that they're going to vote on is very similar, if not identical, to the one that nearly became a constitutional amendment back in the mid-1990s. Some folks say that's great. Other folks say it'd be even better if we had a definite line in there of what percentage of GDP spending had to be capped at. But nonetheless, given what would have been the debt ceiling deal if Democrats had been in office, the fact that this is going to hit the floor, even though it probably won't pass, means that the discussion's headed in the right direction, I think.
Cut, cap, and balance, I thought to myself, was that the Carter administration? It seems like 40 years ago how quickly the news cycle moves. I mean, I think it's basically a good idea, the balanced budget amendment. We here at National Review are actually fairly divided on whether this is the way to get federal spending under control. I think the key is enforceability. If I could be convinced that the balanced budget amendment could be enforced, I'd probably get behind it. But as we've seen with PAYGO rules, all sorts of other things, Congress finds a way to interpret the rules so that they can do whatever they want. And then the problem that you have, and Ramesh Panuru is great on this, is that if Congress tries to weasel its way out of a balanced budget amendment in 20 years, now the Supreme Court of the United States has to get involved and interpret our budgetary rules. So, you know, you might be setting up a constitutional crisis. I think it's great that they're having the vote. I think politically it's smart to put Democrats on record on this sort of thing. The substance of the amendment, I'm not sold on. Frankly, I'm not smart enough to have, I think, a definitive opinion. It makes me nervous.
And like we said, it probably won't get two-thirds in the House, and it certainly won't get two-thirds in the Senate. So it's more of a exercise than an actual movement.
And an important one, yeah.
It is, it is. And it certainly puts the spending issue right back out there out front, and hopefully it'll remain a major focus of the campaign heading into 2012. But on to martini number two now. And, you know, Dan, we've talked before, Jim and I certainly have, about snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. We saw Greece almost do that with the euro last week, and we are watching the Obama administration do it now with this Canadian pipeline, something that is basically a given for thousands upon thousands upon thousands of jobs. The pipeline, we've seen it in Alaska, we've seen it in other places. Its environmental impact is negligible at best, probably none. We even see in some places where the caribou actually propagate better than they had before it was there. And so this is just a great way to get energy from a reliable neighbor that doesn't fund terrorism with our money. It's a great way to add energy jobs all the way down to Texas and throughout the country, as this would be a huge partnership with Canada. And the Obama administration, while not killing it, is deferring it for a whole host of reasons till after the election, which means if they win, they probably will kill it. And the Canadians are upset, and so should all Americans.
Yeah, I mean, you hit all the reasons for supporting this right on the head. And they're reasons President Obama should love. I mean, this is a shovel-ready, quote-unquote, infrastructure, quote-unquote, reducing our dependence on foreign oil, all things that the Obama administration has been crowing about since they got into office is crucially important. And yet, you know, a couple of environmentalist groups have halted construction of this thing. There's two dynamics here which I think are interesting. One is there's this paper out by the CSIS, the Center for Strategic International Studies, about whether you support this thing or not. This is a bad way to do energy policy, is to just have interest groups making huge political fights over every single project. Well, you know, the environmentalists have basically lost the fight over, you know, the energy future of this country, more or less. I think they're in the process of losing it. Everybody knows oil's not going to be around forever, but right now it's the most viable, economically feasible, and you know, energy efficient solution we have going. So because environmentalists have lost that greater battle, they're focusing all their energy on political energy on killing individual projects like this, which, you know, meet all the criteria for a job-creating, environmentally minimally impactful, and economically advantageous project. So that's one thing that I think is unfortunate about this. The other thing is you hit on as well is that this administration is quick as deferred. It feels like they've deferred 90% of their decisions to the second Obama administration, right? From Obamacare all the way down. I mean, it was fishy, you know, when they passed Obamacare, that most of its, you know, revenue-raising measures and regulatory effects only kicked in the year that a President Obama's second administration would start. And we've seen that time and time again, kicking the can down the road. And kicking the can down the road to a very specific point down the road, which is sometime after January 2013.
This is an administration that is either going to be making a lot of horrible decisions if it gets reelected, or will be leaving a lot of difficult decisions and a lot of messes to clean up for the new incoming Republican administration.
Hey, but look at it this way, Greg. Herman Cain can blame Obama for 3 years.
At least. At least. That clock hasn't expired yet, last I checked. On to martini number three now. And yesterday in our second martini, we cringed and Dan talked about his aversion to awkwardness as he had to listen again to Rick Perry forget what his third cabinet department was that he would abolish. But Rick Perry doing about as well as you can do in recovering from that, at least on a social level yesterday. Made the rounds on all the morning shows talking about how the important thing was that he it was a conservative and he had the principles were in the right order. And then even went on David Letterman and did the top 10 list of Rick Perry excuses for having a brain freeze in the debate. And here was number 10.
Actually, there were three reasons I messed up last night. One was the nerves. Mm-hmm. And two was the headache. Mm-hmm. And three,
So, Dan, I don't know if this makes him a caricature of himself a little bit or maybe diminishes himself, but I like the idea that a politician can laugh at himself. That's something I think that most of us liked about President Bush. Reagan had a great sense of humor, and I think people generally respond to that well. Not sure if it'll impact the campaign that much, but it's good to see a human side and a self-effacing side in the wake of something like that.
I could nitpick a little bit about, you know, Governor Perry responding to this, I think partially because my job is to tune into all this stuff, but it did seem like a little bit of overkill. He was on Fox News half a dozen times yesterday, and he did Letterman. But I thought the Letterman top 10 list was, you know, is fairly good. You're right, he's very comfortable laughing at himself, and I think his campaign handled this swiftly and forcefully, and I think he's done a fairly good job, as you said, as good a job as can be expected in trying to defuse the situation. I do think, though, that he's wrong about, you know, emphasizing, look, I'm not a great debater. He said the other day, if you want to elect a debater in chief, don't vote for me. Well, you know what? It's not that you're going to have to debate as president, although certainly conversing with your cabinet and your trusted advisors is a big part of the job, and being able to convince, you know, people and form consensus is a big part of the job. Not only that, but you're going to have to debate Barack Obama. Yeah, doing well in the debates is important, and I don't buy this line from Perry that it's not reflective of any broader weakness in his campaign that he keeps messing up the debates.
Yeah, and I go back to the line I've had about this race, among other things with this field of Republican candidates. We have not had an articulate nominee since 1984, and I don't think it's too much to ask to have one who can speak in complete sentences, who remembers what their policy positions were, and are able to marshal an argument against their Democratic opponent. I really don't think that's too high of a bar to clear.
That's a very good point.
And just as an exit, today's Veterans Day, and it's a very special one. It's 11-11-11. It's the first Armistice Day that we have not had an American World War veteran still living among us. So it's important that we remember that, but also, of course, that we remember everyone and pay tribute to everyone, all of our listeners out there, and everyone who has ever worn the uniform of the United States and served us valiantly in whatever role you played. You played a role that mattered, and we thank you for your service.
Absolutely. I would certainly echo everything you've said there, and reminds me of this. I was working for a local newspaper a few years ago, and one of the things that you get to do as a local newspaper reporter is go cover things like grade school assembly, like K through 5, on Veterans Day, and they had a bunch of vets in there, and the kids sang a song, which I think has become a standard kind of around the country, and it says, if you're thankful for your freedom, thank a vet, and that's certainly the sentiment I have today.
Absolutely. Dan, a great way to end the week. Again, happy Veterans Day to all our veterans. Thank you for your service. Dan, we'll talk to you on Monday.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Dan Foster of National Review Online, and for Jim Garrity, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Monday for the next Three Martini Lunch.